Welcome to Processing Distortion, the podcast series here at BoilingFrogsPost.com. And this podcast will also be distributed at PeterBCollins.com. And if you haven't guessed, I'm your host, Peter B. Collins. This is the podcast where we break down information, misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, and try to get down to the bare truth. This is the second interview with Todd McFarlane. He joined us about 2 weeks ago to talk about the occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge near Burns, Oregon. And Todd McFarlane is an attorney, he is a rancher, he's an activist, a pretty talented writer, and he knows many of the parties involved in not only the Bundy event in Nevada in 2014, this Bundy event in Oregon in 2016, and he, I think, has a good grasp of the issues that Western ranchers have and face with the federal government. Todd, it's good to talk to you again. Thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here, Peter.
Now, since we last spoke in early February, events did come to some sort of closure as the final four protesters left the wildlife refuge. And it was a bit of a drama, brought in some outside players, including Franklin Graham and a legislator from Nevada named Michelle Fiore. Let me put it this way to you, because one of the benefits I've had from talking to you is getting a different take than what the corporate media has brought us. So how would you like to describe the kind of sequence of events that brought closure to this standoff or protest in Oregon? And how does your perspective differ from what we read about in the mainstream media, Todd?
Well, that's a good question, Peter. I had all kinds of mixed feelings and emotions about all of that. I was very glad to see it brought to a conclusion. Mm-hmm. I was very glad to see that it was brought to a conclusion that did not include any more violence. But it was way more dramatic than I had hoped that it would be. And I think that's largely, I guess, kind of attributable to those last four holdouts, if you will, that were on the ground. Mm-hmm. And it was very painful for me to listen to that live stream and kind of, and I don't think they were making anything up in terms of their raw emotions and what they were feeling and things like that, but it was very painful for me to, at a number of different levels, to think that they were experiencing those kinds of emotions and reacting the way they were. From my perspective, it didn't cast any of this in any more positive light on any side, including the side of those that were still holding out in the refuge. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I am very glad to see that it did come to a conclusion. And I guess we pick up the pieces and try to move forward from here.
Let me ask you just to comment on this account from the New York Times about the final hours, particularly as David Fry was the final person who left the scene there. And they wrote it up this way: for the next hour and a quarter, sitting alone in a tent, hugging a blanket, he veered between resignation and agitation, rambling across a wide range of issues and conspiracy theories as the audience listening on the live stream climbed as high as 30,000. Fry said that bankers caused wars, that the government suppressed breakthrough inventions, and was chemically castrating everybody, and occasionally he could be heard talking on another phone with the FBI. Then suddenly it was over. One more cookie, one more cigarette, he said, just before leaving his hideout. All righty, then. Now, there's a lot contained in this description from the New York Times, and some of it is it conveys opinion, and it characterizes him. For example, to talk about, the banking problems and some of these other issues, those aren't conspiracy theories. And so to basically sum this up as Fry is a raving, not quite lunatic, but an extremist who has incoherent thoughts. Is that consistent with your impressions of David Fry?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question, Peter. I've had all kinds of mixed feelings about David Frye, too. There was a period of time when I didn't realize that he was among the final holdouts. I was so buried with other things. But as I kind of had the opportunity to drill down and figure a few things out, number one, I realized, first of all, that I had met David Frye when I was in Oregon on the 8th and 9th. He arrived while I was there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I did have some impressions of him. He was cut from a completely different cloth than virtually anyone else that was there. So he wasn't, you know, dressed in Western attire for sure. He didn't have any of the battle rattle that was perceived to be present, no firearms, anything like that. He basically looked like a hippie, which seemed kind of out of character, and I think he was kind of treated that way basically by most of the people that were there. I didn't really get to know him well or anything like that. I did figure out that he had some significant tech savvy above and beyond what anyone else there probably had.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've kind of connected the dots since then, this is kind of my assessment of David Frye at this point in time. I think a lot of people maybe learned a little bit about his background and that sort of thing, but my perception is this, that he is a person who's basically been an outcast and mistreated his entire life. I think he's been bullied, but, I mean, that probably started in the school system, probably has to do something with his mixed-race background, who knows what else, his appearance, everything about him, but for whatever reason, I think that he has been mistreated. He's been persecuted. I think that from what I can see, that would probably be kind of hard to deny. I think he probably has some degree of persecution complex as a result of that. And this is one of the things about this whole thing that I find fascinating, is that in that whole history of his life, and it seemed that's kind of a consistent theme, somehow, at some point, he made a connection, and this would have been electronically via the internet, whether it was on some kind of discussion forum or whatever the case may be, but mm-hmm. somehow he made a connection with LaVoy Finicum, and they started communicating and that sort of thing. And my perception is this, that in David Frye's entire life, LaVoy Finicum may have been one of the only people that really treated him like a human being and really treated him like a person of value. And I think that created not just an impression, but all kinds of other things in terms of David Frye's willingness to pack his bags in Ohio, head to Oregon, and basically go there to help out LaVoy Finicum if he could. And I think that's a lot of the reasons he was there. But I think a lot of his, if you want to call them rantings, ravings, whatever the case may be, are a product of that kind of a background. That's mm-hmm. that's the way I assess it, Peter.
All right. Now, one of the other people who was involved that we talked about in our first installment, Todd, was Pete Santilli. And he, likewise, is very tech-savvy, was doing a lot of live streaming and, you know, pumping out tweets and other messages. And I just want to ask you this, and I first want to tell you the source. A video blogger from New Zealand, who I had never heard of before, was conducting an interview and has suggested that Pete Santilli was an FBI plant, an informant or provocateur. And you may or may not have any speculation about that, but it's pretty obvious to anybody who watches episodic drama on TV that the FBI would have attempted to insert a plant of some sort into the group of protesters who were hanging out and holding up at the wildlife refuge buildings there. So do you have any comment on Santilli, and do you have any suspicions that he might have been a provocateur?
Well, I have to come to the same conclusion you or anyone else that's kind of informed and been around the block at all, just observant, I'll say, is that, yeah, there's no question in my mind that the FBI would probably try to do something like that. And I don't think just try. I think that it occurred. And I think that those kinds of operatives, I'm going to call them, were fully present and doing their jobs in that situation. Now, whether or not Pete Santilli was one of them, kind of operating on behalf of the FBI, that I can't say. Personally, I would find that a stretch. Not that he wasn't very provocative, because he was. And you and I talked about Santilli last mm-hmm. time we talked, mm-hmm. and I definitely feel like he was a provocateur. I just don't know what all the motivations and what, you know, kind of who his master was in that sense. That mm-hmm. that is unclear to me, but he was definitely a provocative figure in the whole scheme of things.
Now, last time, and forgive me, I can't summon the name he used, but there's an individual who insisted on driving Ammon Bundy to this event in the neighboring county, in Grant County. And I'm wondering if you have any further information on him. Was he detained? Has he been booked? And do we know his actual identity?
Right. So, again, the name that has been associated with that person, and I'll just say it if I haven't said it before, I am highly suspicious of him, mm-hmm. but the name that has been associated with him is Mark McConnell. And so I think since we spoke last, I've had the opportunity to speak with several people who were there in the whole lead-up to this, including Shauna Cox, and kind of get her take on things. What she told me is that this Mark McConnell, whoever he actually is, showed up there just like 2 days prior to the roadblock event. And so he just shown up just very recently. Now, whether he'd been there before, I've heard someone attempting to interview him and ask questions, and I think he made it sound like at some point early on he had gone there to try to extract someone else from the refuge that was there. Again, there may be some more backstory there that I don't completely understand, and it doesn't make complete sense to me. But mm-hmm. he did arrive there. He was, I think, from my perspective, just taken into their confidences just amazingly easily. I don't know how he was able to gain kind of the access that he did as quickly and unvetted as he was, but for whatever reason, that happened. And then within just, say, 48 hours of his arrival, they were going to be traveling to Grant County to meet with the sheriff, among other things. And from what I understand, he absolutely insisted that he drive, that they go in his Jeep, and that Ammon was in his Jeep with him. Mm-hmm. And so they set it all up that way, and then he ends up driving up there, and when they hit the first roadblock, if you will, his vehicle is quickly swarmed by law enforcement vehicles. He pulls over and just acts pretty cooperative, and the next thing you know, that arrest occurs without incident. And mm-hmm. it's my understanding that when this whole thing was said and done, yes, two people that in that whole scheme of things, and we could go down the list of people that were involved in those two vehicles, the two people basically that were let go and weren't held for further questioning or charging or anything else were Victoria Sharp, who was basically just dumped out in a Safeway parking lot in the middle of the night, and the other one was Mark McConnell, who was reunited with his Jeep, and away he went, you know. So it's just a matter of kind of connecting the dots mm-hmm. about that sort of thing. Again, some speculation, of course,
right.
But anyway, that's the way it looks.
Now, you mentioned Victoria Sharp, along with Shauna Cox and, I believe, Ryan Bundy. They were the passengers in Lavoie Finicum's truck on January 26 when they hit the roadblock, and we went into some detail about the shooting of Mr. Finicum in that incident. First of all, Shauna Cox, have you been able to get any additional information from her, or is she still in custody?
She's not in custody. She was actually released. Let's see, I lose track of time, but she was released in time that she could. She is a native of Kanab, Utah, right on the Utah-Arizona border. She was released in time that she was able to make it back to her hometown of Kanab in time for Lavoie Finicum's funeral. The morning of the funeral, she had an emergency hearing in Portland. It ended up being a telephonic hearing that I was able to listen in on, where she was asking the judge for permission to be able to attend the funeral. It surprised me that there would be a restriction on something like that, but apparently there was, not necessarily from the judge, but the prosecutors were requesting that she not be allowed to attend the funeral. And just a side note about Shauna and what she had going on at that point in her life. So Lavoie had been killed. His funeral was occurring on Friday. The next day was a funeral for her son-in-law, who had been killed in a tragic shop fire that week. That's what was going on in Shauna's world at that time. Mm-hmm. But the judge did allow her to attend Lavoie Finicum's funeral.
And have you been able to interview her or even talk to her casually to get more information on her perspective on the events at the roadblock and, in particular, the sequence that led to the shooting death of Lavoie Finicum?
Yes, I had an opportunity to do that, actually had a couple of opportunities to do that. And the reality is, I suppose, if we took the time to try to go into, you know, minute detail about that sort of thing, I don't know that we'd have a chance to talk about anything else. But if you have specific questions about that, Peter, I'd be happy to address those to the best of my ability.
Well, in particular, was Lavoie armed? Was he reaching for a sidearm in his belt, as the government claims, in their rationale for shooting him dead with multiple gunshot wounds?
All right, so this is what Shauna told me, and we talked about that in detail. And at the end of the day, Shauna would have to say, and did say, I don't know exactly what he had on his person, but she said, this I know. She said, number one, he virtually always, and anyone who had seen pictures of him or was there, knew that he was a very traditional cowboy kind of a guy, and he wore a very traditional, old-fashioned Western gun belt with a six-shot revolver in it and cartridge belt and all of that stuff. And that's not the gun that has ever been identified as him having on his person at the time. And she said the reason that it hasn't been identified is because that pistol and that gun belt were on the seat of his truck. And what she said to me was this. She said that they had discussed all this. They had been going to public meetings. They'd been traveling outside the refuge for a week or two. And she said that they understood that Oregon did not basically recognize reciprocity with other Western states with respect to concealed carry permits.
Mm-hmm.
And so they knew that, number one, they knew that they could open carry a firearm and do that legally in the state of Oregon, but that they couldn't concealed carry a firearm in the state of Oregon under the auspices that it would be legal based on the fact that they had a concealed carry permit in another state. She said that was an understanding among all of them. They talked about it before they went to these other meetings, and so they were trying to exercise precaution. They didn't want to do anything that was illegal, so the understanding they had among them was that they would not conceal carry. She said that she had made that conscious decision, even though she had a concealed carry permit in the state of Utah, that she had done her research. She'd figured out that Oregon doesn't recognize reciprocity, and so she hadn't even taken a firearm with her to Oregon and didn't carry a firearm the entire time that she was there, including on that occasion. And then she said above and beyond that, they knew that if they went to public meetings like they were going to, it would be alarming to many members of the public and things to have them walk in open carrying firearms. And so in those situations, they, you know, had talked about, and it was a conscious decision that, number one, we won't go into those meetings open carrying, and we can't conceal carry legally, so we will go into those situations completely unarmed. So her position was she couldn't say for sure whether there may or may not have been a concealed firearm on his person, but based on her understanding and the discussions that she had, that they had had, she had a hard time thinking that there was.
All right. One of the other things that you relayed was that as he stepped out of the truck into this snowbank with his hands up, Lavoie Finicum was apparently taunting the law enforcement officers who were arrayed around him and who ultimately shot him. Did she add anything to that brief sequence of events? It is only about maybe 10 seconds at the most from the time he exited the truck until he recoiled from the first shot hitting him.
What she said about that was that they were taking gunfire from just as soon as the vehicle was plowing into the snow and coming to a stop. They were taking gunfire. They were being fired upon. So what she said is immediately Lavoie jumped out of the truck, and basically he, with his hands up, and he was saying basically this: if you want to shoot somebody, shoot me. Shoot me. That was kind of the way she phrased it. And her whole perception of that was that he was trying to draw any gunfire, any risk of injury or anything like that away from the vehicle, away from the other passengers, and that was the way she said, in terms of how he was saying it, what he was doing, that seemed to be his entire intent, because they were already shooting, that he was saying, if you're going to shoot somebody, shoot me.
All right. And let me turn next to Victoria Sharp. She also, as I referenced, was a passenger in Finicum's truck. And you described to me in an off-air conversation yesterday, Todd, that she was kind of being pulled in all directions by her mother, by the Bundys, and by the people you call patriot groups. Describe a little bit what the issues were, and have you been able to get any clear statements from Victoria Sharp on the roadblock incident?
You know, kind of answering your last question first, I've had an opportunity now, finally, and I was looking forward and hoping to get that opportunity for quite some time before the circumstances came together that I was able to spend, you know, a fairly significant amount of time with her and kind of really understand, you know, what her perspective on the whole thing was, basically her account, her testimony of what happened. I don't know that I really want to get into all the details of that right now. I will say this, that under the circumstances, something I felt very strongly about was that she needed to have her, what we call, deposition taken.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than give a statement or sign an affidavit or anything like that, the thing that needed to happen with her in particular was that she needed to have her deposition taken, which is much like courtroom testimony, except not in court. But it's taken under oath, it's recorded, it's transcribed, and most importantly, it's subject to cross-examination. So there are attorneys present. They ask direct examination questions. She tells her side of the story, basically. And then other attorneys who represent the opposing interests, if you will, have an opportunity to cross-examine. And the reason I feel like that's really important is because it's only with testimony that's preserved in that fashion that it is really admissible under the rules of evidence in this hypothetical scenario. So the reason I guess there's a lot of concern about Victoria Sharp, and to really, I think, understand kind of what that concern is, what I often refer to, and I think it kind of portrays, you know, what the concerns are, is the movie Witness. Are you familiar with the movie Witness, Peter?
I have not seen it, nope.
All right, so there was a movie that came out in the 80s, I don't remember exactly when, but it starred Harrison Ford and Kelly McGillis. Kelly McGillis, if some will remember, was the female star in the Tom Cruise movie Top Gun, back in that same era.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the movie Witness is about a little Amish boy in Pennsylvania who is traveling with his mother to visit family, and they were completely fish out of water, if you will, in an urban train station in, say, Philadelphia, and the little Amish boy goes into the restroom, and while he's there, witnesses what I'll describe as a dirty cop murder. And so he becomes this critical witness and the only witness. And so once some people figure, including law enforcement, figure out what's going on, then they realize how much danger he's in. And so it goes through this, I mean, that's what the movie is all about, basically, the risks that he was subjected to and the reasons why he needed to be protected. They got him back into Amish country as quickly as they could. It's really an interesting movie from my perspective, but it helps explain and basically portray the situation that Victoria Sharp, I think, finds herself in at this point, especially according to some perceptions. So according to these, especially, again, patriot groups, that sort of thing, they feel very strongly that because she is kind of the most neutral third-party witness, if you will, in that whole situation, that given her eyewitness accounts and everything, that she could potentially be at some risk and in danger, and that someone could potentially want to not have her be available to testify. And so it's in that situation that a deposition is especially important, because that's a way to preserve that testimony in such a way that even in a worst-case scenario, if something were to happen to Victoria or someone like her, the testimony would be preserved in such a way that it could still be admissible in court under the rules of evidence.
So, Todd, are the accounts that you've heard from Victoria Sharp and Shauna Cox consistent?
They really are. There was very little, if any, inconsistency between their accounts. There was maybe a little bit of inconsistency with respect to the exact sequence of what happened at the initial stop, in terms of exactly what Ryan Payne said, when he said it, that sort of thing. But aside from that, there was, and I had the opportunity to really kind of put those two accounts side by side and found that there were very, very few inconsistencies at all between their respective accounts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Michelle Fiore is a member of the state legislature in Nevada. She is a candidate for Congress. She's a bit of a media hound, and she inserted herself into the final chapter of the events in Oregon as kind of a self-appointed negotiator. And she was driving there and, you know, listening to the live stream and talking to some of the people who remained. Do you regard her as a useful participant in this, or was she grandstanding?
Now, that's a good question, Peter, and I have really mixed thoughts about that. I really don't know that much about Michelle Fiore. I don't know exactly how she came to be on the phone line right at that moment and how all that came about. And And, you know, this is kind of a backstory, Peter, that may mean something to you, but because that was happening and because our good friend Sabelle was very interested in seeing what, if anything, she might be able to contribute to that situation based on her experiences and things, she and I actually ended up in a text loop with Michelle while all of this was going on. And just basically asking, you know, what could be done, what assistance could be offered in any way, whether it was logistics, transportation, and you know how dramatic things were right at that moment. And so it was strange in a way that we ended up in that text loop that they were responding to us just trying to say, what can we do to try to see if we can't help get, you know, you let us know what we can do to help out. And that came, you know, at it was really Sabelle that initiated and wanted to do what she could do to help in that regard. And the opportunity in the long run did not end up presenting itself, but there was an effort being made to do that. Because at that point in time, for whatever reason, Michelle Fiore was the person, whether she inserted herself, whether she was invited, whether she was qualified, I don't know, but she is one of the people that eventually helped bring it to a conclusion. And so I don't know what else we can say about that other than to tip our hats to her. And, you know, I think a lot of what she did, for whatever reason, ended up being pretty effective.
I want to ask you to respond to this, Todd. I picked up a piece online from a newspaper called the Daily Astorian, and Astoria, of course, is on the coast of Oregon.
Right.
And this article compares the two sheriffs, Dave Ward of Harney County, who was very aggressive in trying to get the protesters to leave, and his counterpart in the neighboring county, whose name is Glenn Palmer, the sheriff of Grant County. And Sheriff Palmer is described as very sympathetic to the protesters, and that appears to be the reason they were going to the meeting, the town hall meeting, on January 26, because they considered him to be sympathetic or at least supportive of some of their aims. And this article basically kind of brings it down, at least the focus of it and the framing of it, is that these two sheriffs responded very differently to these outsiders arriving to launch a protest based on a local issue, the resentencing of the Hammonds, father and son, and ranchers in that area. So do you have any comment on the difference between Sheriff Ward and Sheriff Palmer? And do you believe that Palmer was in some ways irresponsible?
You know, I'm really glad you asked that question, Peter. That's something that I really, you know, and there will be all kinds of different opinions about this. And, of course, all I can do is talk about my opinion about it. I think in this, I don't know what we want to call it, but basically this spectrum, this scenario, there is an ideology, there's some thinking that certainly a number of the people that were involved in this basically subscribe to. And I think it's been articulated most and kind of been advanced by a retired Arizona County Sheriff by the name of Richard Mack. And he has gone around the country, and he has given presentations, and he's done seminars and things like that, basically articulating his position and his position, and he's written some books about this and things like that. But his position basically is that constitutionally and under our system of government, in any county, the person who has the most power and authority in any county in this entire country is the county sheriff. And that in that county, the county sheriff has supreme authority. And that if the federal government, if the FBI, if anyone like that wants to operate or do something there, it should be at the county sheriff's invitation, and it should be with and I should say his or her, because you could definitely have a female county attorney, but it should be with their blessing. It should be with the locals' blessing. And so I think that the way you phrase this, I think, really does juxtapose these two sheriffs. You've got one sheriff, Sheriff Ward, in Harney County, who I think is perceived by the people on the ground, or whatever the case may be, that were there, the occupiers, that sort of thing, to be the complete antithesis of that ideology. In other words, I think he was viewed to be nothing more than a puppet of the federal government, that they were pulling his strings, and that he really wasn't acting independently in any way, shape, or form, that basically he was doing their bidding. And then I think you've got Sheriff Palmer, who, according again to that ideology, would basically be subscribing to the Richard Mack philosophy that the local county sheriff has more authority and is the person who should be calling the shots, basically, at the local level in that kind of a scenario, and he should not be doing it influenced or having any strings pulled by the federal government. And so, in terms of my perspective, again, I do subscribe to the concept that a county sheriff has that authority in the county, and that the county sheriff is the person under those circumstances who should be taking the lead. And this is my perspective above and beyond that.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I think that if Sheriff Palmer had been the sheriff of Harney County when this whole thing kind of ended up the way it did, and the occupation occurred, but within a short amount of time, it became obvious that something else needed to happen, it needed to be resolved, there needed to be a transition. My perception is that if Sheriff Palmer had been the sheriff in Harney County, Ammon Bundy and those people would have basically said, we're going to leave, we're going to turn over this land, these facilities that we have occupied. I think, according to their view of things, they would have kind of put it like, we're going to turn this over in trust to you as the county sheriff, as someone that we trust, to kind of hold until this thing is resolved in terms of their idea of the dispute over who should really be entitled to control that property. But I think that they felt like he was the kind and caliber of person that they would be willing to do that. But they weren't willing to do that with Sheriff Ward because they didn't feel like, he merited their trust, their confidence, anything like that. So that's my perception of that, Peter.
And let me quote for our listeners from The Historian. Sheriffs occupy a unique place in American law enforcement. In Oregon, they must be certified by the Board of Police Standards and Training, but they're not hired in the manner of a police chief or FBI agent. They're elected at the ballot box. That allows many of them to assume they have leeway that police chiefs do not, and it gives a sheriff the opportunity to make boneheaded moves, unchecked by a superior. Prior to the appearance of the Malheur Refuge occupier, Sheriff Palmer decided last September that he would write a natural resource management plan for Grant County. The county court, its governing body, reminded Palmer that he had no authority to do so. He then made sheriff's deputies the group of 11 citizens that executed this task. It goes on, in his remarks beckoning the lawbreakers inside the Malheur Refuge, Sheriff Palmer exhibited three self-destructive characteristics. As with his baseless attempt to write a county natural resources plan, he acted as though he were a law unto himself. And by intimating that the armed lawbreakers would be welcomed in Grant County, he undercut the sheriff of Harney County. Thirdly, Palmer chose to destabilize the community's security and stability, for which he is responsible. So that's, I think, a counter perspective to what you offered, Todd. Do you want to comment?
It is. You're absolutely right. And so what I would say is that basically you had two sheriffs that kind of were on opposite sides of the spectrum, basically. And, there will be all kinds of different views of that. And I acknowledge that, mm-hmm. There will be all kinds of opinions. And there will be all kinds of justification for those kinds of opinions. And so I recognize, and to be completely honest, I haven't known part of what is being represented in that article in terms of Sheriff Palmer taking it upon himself to write a county natural resources management plan, that sort of thing. But I will say this, that I think that that is the responsibility of the local government level. I think that's something that all counties should be doing. I think that that's part of their important role. Now, whether it's the county sheriff that should be doing that or not, you know, typically we would think that that would be someone else at the local county government level. But so I don't know all the backstory there, and I'm reluctant to try to address that fully without all of that backstory. But I will just say this, it does appear that those two were on opposite sides of the spectrum in that regard.
Indeed. There's one other article I'm going to link to in the show file for this podcast that I think offers interesting observations about the standoff, written by a man who's a self-described Second Amendment activist, a writer who ranches in Montana. His name is Hal Herring. And I shared that with you, Todd, and I think he does have some interesting perspectives on what occurred there. Finally, before we move on to a kind of broader discussion about the issues that motivate these confrontations, I want to note that Cliven Bundy was arrested in Portland, Oregon. I believe he was there visiting his son, Ammon, and he is now being charged with felony conspiracy to impede officers of the United States from discharging their official duties, and that goes back to the 2014 standoff in Nevada. Do you have any comment on Cliven Bundy's arrest? Was this problematic in any way? Because it seems that they waited a long time follow up on whatever charges had been filed, and that this was opportunistic as he went to Portland to visit his son in jail.
You know, I have a lot of issues with all of that, to be completely honest. And I know that there are all kinds of people out there, and I know that probably, you know, you've got a number of listeners and subscribers that, depending on their background, depending on their paradigms and things like that, probably have wondered, why in the world hasn't Cliven Bundy been arrested before now? Why hasn't he been charged with a whole myriad of things? And to be completely honest, I think that the federal government has really struggled to try to figure out what they could charge him with, or Ammon and Ryan and the others. They came up with this charge of conspiracy to impede federal officers. Now, I'm just going to say it right off the bat. As I've examined that, and I look at it, I think that that whole statute has some serious problems. I would say that there's a serious constitutionality issue with respect to that statute. I would say that it is arguably unconstitutionally void for vagueness, because I don't think it really puts a person of ordinary intelligence on any meaningful notice as to exactly what the conduct would be that would be considered to be unlawful.
Well,
Todd,
you're the lawyer here, but I just have to say, on the face of it, to call it a felony charge of conspiracy to impede officers, all right, if you just take those three elements individually, to call it a felony to impede an officer, it's not an assault, it's not resisting arrest.
Exactly.
It is so vague, it reminds me of the murky zone of material support for a terrorist group.
Right,
that,
exactly.
That could be as simple as buying a T-shirt, you know?
Right, that's right, exactly. And so, I mean, for them now to come up with those kinds of charges and basically rely on those as the auspices for charging and arresting Cliven Bundy, and I find this very interesting, Peter, and I don't know everything about this, and I don't pretend to be the ultimate expert on these issues, but I need to study this some more, but I find this very interesting, and I hope that some of your listeners and subscribers, to the extent they're open-minded about this, will find this interesting as well. as I've studied those charges, because I know that a lot of people have said and they've expressed this sentiment, why in the world hasn't Cliven Bundy been charged criminally for terminating his grazing permits? Why hasn't he been charged criminally for not paying his grazing fees? They just can't for the life of them understand why that hasn't happened. And now, when I examine the charges that have been leveled against him, and it looks to me like the federal government is basically trying to throw the book at him, there aren't any criminal charges associated with those things. In other words, termination of his grazing permit and failure to pay grazing fees. And so my question is, what does that tell us? What does that tell us with respect to... Now, so they're all based on the actions that occurred in Bunkerville with respect to the protest and the people that arrived there, and that they were armed, and that some of those people pointed firearms at federal agents, operatives, mercenaries, all of the above, and that Cliven Bundy somehow instigated that. But in terms of getting down to the brass tacks, what was this all about? It was about whether or not he was somehow operating illegally in terms of grazing his cattle on these ranges and not paying grazing fees. And there's no criminal charges associated with that. So I find that very interesting, and I hope people will kind of start asking themselves some questions about that.
And, Todd, this is the perfect springboard, because I wanted to ask you to explain to our listeners, and in particular, I'm talking about people like me. I live in an urban area. I've never ranched. I've never dealt with the Bureau of Land Management or the U.S. Forest Service in a happy way or a conflicting way.
Right.
But I have, you know, at least a limited understanding of the issues in play. And a lot of this goes back to a century and a half ago to the Homestead Act, which decreed that if you go and find a plot of land in the West and you bring water to it and you raise cattle or you farm it and you basically improve it, it's yours. And I learned about the Homestead Act in high school in government class. And to my knowledge, the Homestead Act has never expired or been repealed. So is it a good starting point for amateurs like us? We don't have the skills to go into a legal seminar here, Todd. But when we look at the big picture about the gripes that Western ranchers have with the federal government, does it start with issues arising from the Homestead Act and the understanding that generations of family members have had that this land is theirs?
I think it can actually go back even before the Homestead Act, but I think you're hitting on something important here, Peter, and I think it's something important to understand. And I don't necessarily I want to be careful about characterizing this as basically saying that those people feel like the land is theirs. Now, I want to make reference to that article that you've linked to your podcast that you referred to. Remind me of that writer's name that wrote that for the High Country News.
Hal Herring.
Yes, Hal Herring. I found that to be a very interesting article, too. And he talked about some things in there that caused me to understand that he has a pretty darn deep understanding of some of the background of this, especially when he started talking, for example, about the Arizona Strip, which is a place that a lot of people just flat won't know anything about, won't have any reason to know anything about it, but it's an area that I've been interested in for a long time. So the Arizona Strip is basically, and it's a big area, but it's the area located north of the Grand Canyon to the Utah-Arizona state line.
Okay.
And there really are no interior communities out there. It's basically a vast desert landscape that at one time sustained an immense amount of livestock grazing. There were a lot of cattle. He refers to Preston Nutter, who was definitely the cattle baron on the Arizona Strip for a long period of time during his lifetime. He claims that there were 100,000 head of cattle out there. The numbers that I've heard are more like 50,000. It's still a large number of cattle considering the type of barren desert rangeland that it is in a lot of respects and in many places. But in addition to the cattle, there used to be tens of thousands of sheep that wintered out on the Arizona Strip during the wintertime. And so they would often summer in the mountain ranges of Utah, Arizona, even Nevada, and then the Arizona Strip was considered a winter range for sheep operations, and they would go out there and find places out there. So these are migrant nomadic sheep operations, basically. Mm-hmm. And so really we're talking about a period of time, and this goes hand in hand with the Homestead Act, but there were people who at that time went out on the Arizona Strip and they made homestead claims. And they, they did what you're supposed to do. They took possession of the property that they were claiming, and they staked it, and they occupied it, and they took possession of it, and they tried to improve it, and they had water. And a lot of those people at that time, the only water source they had were ponds and rainfall. And that's one thing I'm going to say, too. He talks about the overgrazing on the Arizona Strip that precipitated the Taylor Grazing Act and some of those things. And I think it's fair to say that there was some overgrazing. But the other thing I think, if you really study what's happened on the Arizona Strip, I think it's undeniable, and I know this gets into some things that some people may be uncomfortable talking about, but there was some degree of climate change occurring there 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. At the end of the 1800s and early 1900s, that area, and I speak to this because of family members. In fact, my wife's father was a sheep herder who spent a lot of winters out on the Arizona Strip, and her grandfather, and cowboys like that who, you know, spent lifetimes out there, would all say that at that time that area received a lot more natural precipitation than it does today, and mm-hmm. that area was a vast grassland. And over time, the climate changed. It wasn't as productive, and that's one of the reasons it became overgrazed, because it couldn't sustain the kinds of numbers that had previously been able to sustain. But you've got homesteads out there that basically, and I think what we're talking about here is the basic principles that I think apply to a lot of these western rangelands. So you've got families who go out on the land, they go into the wilderness, they take possession of it, they improve it, they claim it, and under the Homestead Act, they could then receive title to that property. They could call it a ranch. But they also used a lot of other surrounding property, rangeland, because out here in the West, in those kinds of areas, it takes a lot more range than just 40 acres or 160 or 320 or even 640 acres to sustain a family. Mm-hmm. And if you read the language of the Homestead Act and some of those other early acts, that was all part of the language that was included. It was supposed to be areas of land and resources of sufficient size to be able to support a family, basically. That was the concept. And by taking possession of it, mixing their labor, their resources, with the natural resources on the ground, they acquired title to the property. But above and beyond that, even property that they didn't acquire actual title to, they acquired grazing rights. They acquired those through what we would call beneficial use. Mm-hmm. So they may have lived on, say, a section, 640 acres, and that may have been their ranch headquarters, and that's where their crails were and their house and their barns and all of those sorts of things. But their cattle or sheep, their livestock could have even been goats, combination of all of the above, may have grazed tens of thousands of acres that they felt like they acquired these pre-existing grazing rights in based on their beneficial use. And I think that is really getting down to some of the core issues that we're talking about here in the West, Peter.
So then is the tension between these grandfathered rights that the ranchers believe they're entitled to and a more activist federal government. This is BLM under the Department of the Interior and the Forest Service also under the Department of Interior. Has environmentalism and the rise of environmental concerns and environmental legislation been a source of exacerbating this conflict? In other words, is it urban environmentalists who are trying to impose a set of standards on Western ranch lands and these, you know, wide open grazing territories? Is that where you view the conflict coming from?
It really is. That, I think that explains it to a large extent. I think that, again, what we've got in the West are people on the ground to a large extent, on the land, many of whom have been there for generations, and they're trying to figure out a way to continue to be able to scratch out a living in a fairly harsh environment in a lot of ways, and it's never been easy. But they've been doing it. It's a lifestyle they want. It's a lifestyle they want to be able to perpetuate in their families, in their children, their grandchildren. And then you've got, like you say, urban interests to a large extent, far removed from these places, who, some of whom, you know, they want to have access. They want to be able to come to the West. They want to be able to recreate. They want to be able to have access. They want to hike. They mm-hmm. want to sightsee. They want to watch birds, all of those things. And frankly, I don't view those interests to be in conflict. Most of the ranchers that, you know, I'm aware of, and there will always be the exceptions to the rule, but as a general rule, and I live in an area where this is exactly what happens, and most people get along just fine with ranchers utilizing the forage and the water. And anybody else that wants to go out there and respectfully utilize the land and resources for other purposes, whether it's hunting, fishing, riding their four-wheelers, hiking, bird-watching, sightseeing, all of those things, the ranchers aren't trying in any way, shape, or form to exclude them or to limit their access. It's actually the people, to a large extent, from my perspective, a lot of times they would be perceived to have kind of this environmental orientation, mm-hmm. urban areas, not from the West, not on the land. They're the ones that are trying to limit the access of everyone, including the ranchers, to a lot of these areas. They want to close the roads. They want to limit vehicular access. I mean, these are people that have really never had any real, true, direct stake in any of this, who now want to come to the West and limit access and everything else. They want to tie up these lands. They don't want livestock to be able to graze it. They don't want people to be able to have access except on the very limited conditions that they want to prescribe. And I think that's a lot of what's causing the tension at this point in time.
Isn't there also a third player, and that's corporate extraction interests?
Oh, for sure.
Who want
yeah,
to
no
keep,
doubt about that.
Who want to be able to get oil and gas and coal off of public lands to, take out the timber and any minerals that they might be able to find. And there are many people on the rancher side who I think suspect that the corporate interests are using the greens. I think there's some greens who think that the ranchers are being used by the corporate extractors.
Right. Oh, exactly.
And then we've got some nefarious action by the government. And I think that there are a lot of the green types who think that the government only does what is right for the environment and what is consistent with the law. But I acknowledge that the government actions can be arbitrary and capricious and can harm the interests of people who've been working this land in a hardscrabble way for a long time.
So what I think, and kind of as I've given this some thought even since you and I visited a little bit last evening, was that, you know, at the time the Taylor Grazing Act was enacted and some of those acts at the time, there were some issues at that point in time that needed to be addressed. Again, if we use the Arizona Strip as an example, it may have had to do with some of these climate change issues that caused there to not be as much forage as there had previously been. And so those forage resources were being exhausted. There was some overgrazing occurring. There was friction between the ranchers, the resource users. And so the Taylor Grazing Act and others were enacted to kind of help sort that out, to establish grazing allotments, boundaries, that sort of thing. And to be honest, at that point in time, I think that those things did some good. I guess what I'm going to say is now, however many years later it's been, and I see this in all kinds of things, but I think we've had a pendulum that has swung, where at that point in time the federal government probably did some things that were good to try to kind of get a handle on some of that. Mm-hmm. And now I think that the pendulum has swung so far the other direction that they're acting in ways, in many cases, and basically, at least the perception is, under the influence of these other interests, whether it's the environmental interests, whether it's the corporate extraction interest, whether it's a combination of all of the above, but basically they're acting in a way that is detrimental to the ranchers. I mean, I spent 10 years of my early law practice on the Utah-Arizona border in Kanab. That's where I started out. And when I went to Kanab and that whole area, the Arizona Strip, southern Utah, had a very vibrant natural resource-based economy. There were sawmills in Fredonia, Arizona, Panguitch, Escalante. Those were the biggest employers in that area. The North Kaibab produced a lot of timber, and there was a very vibrant ranching economy. There were mines in the area, and it was just a natural resource-based economy in a nutshell, and it had been for many decades. It had followed the boom and bust cycle of the West, which in Kanab in particular was kind of tied more to the movie industry. So juxtaposed to this natural resource economy, there had also been a movie-making economy at some points of time, and there had also been a tourism economy based on the national parks and that sort of thing. But the bottom line is, from the time that I went to Kanab 25 years ago and started practicing law, and this all happened over the course of 10 years, and then I ended up moving to another place, buying a ranch here where we are now, but that all completely changed to the point that now, 25 years later, Kanab really, and that whole area, doesn't have much of a natural resource-based economy at all. Those sawmills have all been shut down because of environmental interests. The Grand Canyon Trust basically was instrumental in shutting down the largest ranchers. They put together a deal where someone came in and bought those ranches and basically sought to remove the cattle entirely. And same thing has happened to the mining and all of those things. So now, at this point, there is some natural resource beneficial use going on, but it's not near to the extent that it used to be. And the problem is, that sort of thing cripples local economies. When you live in the rural areas of the West, and Kanab is blessed in the sense that it has some really remarkable natural scenery and that sort of thing that can allow it to have some tourism and that sort of thing that is not available in a lot of other places, including where I live right now. So if the natural resource economy goes, then what can you replace that with to allow people on the land that have kids and grandkids, what can they do to have an income to support themselves? I mean, eventually somebody's got to get a job, and if there are no jobs to be had, then they have to move away. They have to go mm-hmm. to an urban area, and it just changes the whole dynamic at that point. And that's happened throughout the West over the course of the last 30 or 40 years.
Now, Todd, when it comes to the conflicts over these grazing rights and grazing fees, you told me that you don't have much optimism that this can be resolved from the courts or through legislative action. And you told me that you advocate, and you use careful language, and so I want to present it accurately, that these ranchers can enter, essentially notify the Bureau of Land Management that they are withdrawing consent to be governed by the BLM. And you also advocate that they put grazing fees into an escrow account so that if these issues are properly resolved, that appropriate compensation will be paid. Talk a little bit about this whole idea of consent to be governed, because I have seen this applied in other areas, and I won't distract you with them, but I think it is a very powerful concept of the balance between liberty and the law.
Well, and I completely agree with that, Peter, and that's one of the reasons that I'm kind of rolling up my sleeves to try to address some of those issues. And again, it kind of goes back a little bit to what I was saying before about the approach that Clive and Bundy took, and he was considered to be this just crazy radical, and how could that possibly be justified, you know, that he would terminate his permits and he would quit paying his grazing fees and received a lot of criticism for that. But as I have now tried to educate myself better and understand really what the basis might be for doing something like that, what I've come to understand is, and it's recognized through a whole series of acts, congressional acts, that deal with these lands and resources in the West, that all of those acts always talk about the fact that whatever, whether it's FLIPMA or any of the other federal lands management policy acts that have been implemented over the course of time, they all have language that says that they are subject to pre-existing rights. They're subject to pre-existing rights. So this concept that, like we described before, if a rancher comes into an area and he homesteads, let's say a section or whatever the amount of property is, and he develops that, and then he grazes, and let's say he did that 150 or even 200 years ago, and then he grazes this area around the homestead. He's not claiming that he owns that land, per se, and all the other resources, but he's claiming that he acquires a right to the forage through beneficial use over a long period of time. It's the same concept that underlies water law in the West. It's all about prior beneficial use. And it also is what underlies a lot of our access rights based on what we call prescription. So in other words, if you start using an access across someone else's property and you do that despite the fact that there's nothing recorded, there's nothing at the courthouse, you do that for a long period of time and you engage in what we call adverse use. You just go across their property and you do that for 20 years or more. That ripens into what we call a prescriptive right that results from the beneficial use. And so that's basically this is all, Peter, basically founded in the concepts of natural law. If you really get down to the core concept of natural law, it boils down to possession is 9/10 of the law, and use it or lose it. Whoever uses it basically should be entitled to continue to use it, and if you don't use it, you lose the right to use it. So those are some of the basic fundamental concepts under natural law that underlie all of this. But the idea then is that when we come to the whole concept, and it's derived from language in the Declaration of Independence that recognizes that in our form and system of government, the only power our governments have is basically the power that's derived from consent of the governed. And so that's what it's all about. We consent to be governed by our governments, whether it's the federal government, our state and local governments. They derive all their power by consent of the governed. And so in this context that we're talking about right now, with respect to grazing rights, for example, and that's kind of what we're talking about. The concept is, and that's why it's just a draft. It's just an idea, basically, but we're phrasing that as a withdrawal of consent, that under the right conditions, if a rancher fills, and we encourage ranchers to do that basically in conjunction with what we call a petition for redress of grievances, that they would consider then the possibility of signing and submitting something that's referred to as a withdrawal of consent, mm-hmm. that basically says the only power that the BLM has over these pre-existing grazing rights, not the access, not the mineral rights, mm-hmm. not the oil and gas rights, not any of those things, but only those rights that the rancher has put to beneficial use and his predecessors in interest have put to beneficial use for a long period of time, that they're basically saying, up to that point in time, they've entered into contracts and permits with the BLM to say that we'll agree to be regulated and governed by the BLM according to its, rules and regulations and all of those sorts of things. But mm-hmm. at a certain point in time, if they feel like they want to do that, they basically say, for a variety of reasons, we're going to withdraw our consent to continue on that same basis and to discontinue to be governed by the BLM. That doesn't mean that they intend to rape, pillage, and plunder the land and the resources. That doesn't mean that they are claiming that that land is then their private property and no one else can go there. That doesn't mean that other people won't be able to hunt, fish, recreate, and have access. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they don't necessarily feel like they should be paying grazing fees to someone. They just don't necessarily know who. And so, the concept is that those grazing fees will be paid into some kind of escrow pending determination of who the rightful recipient ought to be.
So, Todd, first of all, I'm very intrigued by this overarching legal framework that you have offered here. And it's persuasive, I have to say, on some levels. When we boil it down to the perspectives that an average American gets from watching television news, the fundamentals are that Cliven Bundy was paying grazing fees to the government, and then he stopped. But he is still grazing on federal lands. And so the simple notion that people come away with is that he is attempting to defraud the government with a very, kind of arcane series of arguments. So how can you square your legal framework, and I respect the integrity of it, with that perception that people are saying, well, basically he was paying and now he's not, but he's continuing to use the rights that he once was paying for?
Well, I think there's a gross misunderstanding of that whole concept of grazing fees and what's supposed to happen to those. I think that what a lot of people must think is that those fees are supposed to somehow come back into the general fund or general coffers of the United States government, and that somehow we, the people of the United States, because Cliven Bundy or whomever else quits paying those grazing fees, are deprived of that amount of income, whatever it is. But if you study the acts that require or suggest that those kinds of fees should be paid, they're basically intended to be administrative fees. And if you go back and study the laws that apply to those carefully enough, what you will find is this, that there's actually a breakdown, that those fees, if that's the way we're going to describe them, it's not a rent, it's not a lease, they're administrative fees that are supposed to go into a special trust fund, and then the laws actually prescribe what's supposed to happen to those funds. And I think it says that 50% of those funds are supposed to go back for what is known as range improvements. So that would be water developments, fencing, removal of brush and other noxious vegetative species and that sort of thing. That is supposed to go back into improving the piece of property. And who's paying for it to be improved? Well, that allottee, that grazing allottee who's paying the grazing fees. And then part of that, I think, as I recall, 25%, is supposed to come back to state and local governments, basically, for keeping the roads open and access and grading the roads and that sort of thing. And I'll have to go back and see what the remaining 25% is supposed to do, but it doesn't go into some general fund or coffer of the United States government. It's all about going back into the use and the administration of those lands and those resources. And I think what we'll find is that even though that's what the law says is supposed to happen, that isn't what has been happening. And so, you know, I think that creates part of the issue here. If someone like Clive and Bundy or anyone else, Lavoie Finicum, or some other rancher who were to decide that they don't want to continue to pay those fees, if they were to understand that those fees were being used as they were intended to be used, as spelled out in those acts, I think that they would be happy to continue to pay those to be used for the purposes that are described. That's mm-hmm. That's the way I, you know, would answer that question, Peter.
All right. And Todd, I'm going to stop here. We could continue this conversation. It might go past the ability of our listeners to take it all in. And also, right. You've got to run to a court hearing in a community a few hours away. So I want to thank you for returning to talk about these issues today. And I look forward to future conversations because I think we've opened up a vein here of important exchange so that people like me can have a better understanding of the motivations of ranchers and their conflicts with the federal government. And what I've learned in these two conversations is that it's a lot more complicated than the corporate media lays it out for Americans. And I really appreciate you helping a guy like me understand what's going on.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to do it, Peter. I think you've summed it up well, and I look forward to those future exchanges as well.
Todd McFarland, thank you for joining me here on Processing Distortion.
You're welcome, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Processing Distortion. I always welcome your comments and feedback. Drop an email to peter@peterbcollins.com.